This is exactly right.
Hello. We want to take a second to tell you about one of our favorite podcasts, Disgraceland. If you like music, pop culture, and true crime, this is the podcast for you.
Through host Jake Brennan's deeply researched storytelling, you'll hear all about the lives and crimes of musicians like Jerry Lee Lewis, Jay-Z, the Rolling Stones, and so many more.
And now Disgraceland is expanding to include artists, actors, athletes, and other icons from Anthony Bourdain to Andy Warhol.
Full episodes are released every Tuesday. Check out Disgraceland on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen.
Goodbye.
Welcome to My Favorite Murder.
This is the podcast where we tell you true crimes and horrible things that happen to good people.
Yeah. And a little about ourselves sometimes when we...
Oh, just a tad. Just a touch about ourselves.
When we feel like going on a tangent.
Which is every single episode for a minimum 49 minutes.
Yeah. But so it's sprinkled throughout.
Get ready. Oh, yeah. Also, we don't just keep it at the top. We'll put it in the middle and then also at the end.
I mean, listen.
Look.
Look and listen.
Okay, so we should probably start with the biggest announcement and the one that people constantly tweet us about and ask us about. Thank you for your interest. We are going on tour again, and we are now going to announce the dates of our Australian and American tour.
Yeah.
Are you ready to hear what we're doing?
Yeah, Australia, you know already, but we're adding a couple shows, actually. So New Zealand, Auckland, is there are still tickets available. It's on Wednesday, September 16th.
And then September 6th.
Thank you. That says September
Wednesday,
6th.
September 6th, the beginning of September.
And then we're adding shows in Melbourne and Sydney because we have two shows in each and they sold, or one, or they sold out. So September 10th in Melbourne at the Comedy Theater.
Melbourne.
And September 12th. In Sydney, Australia, there's another show at the fucking
opera house. At the Sydney Opera House.
Dude.
Side room.
Is that true?
We're in the jazz room. No, I have no idea.
And we're actually in the bathroom. We're just going to be in the bathroom.
Yeah, that's right. If you want to come and talk to us at the Sydney Opera House, we're going to be loitering in the women's bathroom from 9 to 11.
It's actually a chamber orchestra that night, but we'll be in the bathroom.
Yes. Do you want to switch off and we'll just do the dates and cities of each one after?
Yeah.
Okay, so listen to this, you guys. On Friday, September 29th, we're coming to Detroit, Michigan.
So excited for that. On October 13th, San Diego, California.
On October 14th, Anaheim, California.
On October 19th, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
On October 20th, Madison, Wisconsin.
November 3rd, Tampa, Florida.
November 4th, Orlando, Florida.
November 5th, Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
November 10th, this is big. They've been waiting for us. Houston, Texas, we're coming to you.
Fuck yeah. And then November 11th, don't worry, Dallas, we're going to be there.
Oh, hell yeah, Dallas. We saw your TV show. We know how good you can be. December 8th, St. Louis, Missouri.
And then December 9th, Kansas City, Missouri. And that's it for our 2017 tour. And then there's going to be more stuff going on in 2018. But so we also want to tell you guys, okay, so Monday, July 31st at 10 a.m., the pre-sale tickets go on sale, and the password is Murderino, but you have to go to MyFavoriteMurder.com/live and then click the links for each show there, because otherwise some fucking scalpers are going to buy them and tell you that this is the link you want to use, and it's not true.
So if you want the official link, you have to go to MyFavoriteMurder.com/live and then find your city there and buy your tickets off the link that we have listed. We can't read. There's lots of complaints last time about scalping and prices and all that kind of stuff. And that's why we do pre-sale, so our fans that hear this show can get their tickets first. And then you have to do it off the official link. Right. Obviously, we can't, you know, we can't make everything work, but that's, we were trying to make things a little bit better so people aren't like buying some, you know, nasty, weird website tickets that don't exist or whatever.
So Murderino. I'm really excited about a lot of these cities, and I won't say which ones excited about.
That would be great to not for you to not say what you aren't looking forward to.
I'm not gonna do that. Okay. What else do you have?
You got nothing?
No, I have a thing or two.
Let's hear it.
Okay. Well, it's all just like my rambling. but my brother was on a jury where someone died. It was like a race car guys on the street, and they crashed into a car and killed someone. And as he was telling me, my 7-year-old nephew was like, yeah, and like giving me details. So I was like, okay, he knows about it. How cute would it be if I recorded him talking about it in hometown? And so I was like, Micah, tell me what happened. And he was just like, well, someone died. It was so depressing that I was like, well, I'm okay.
Yeah.
I'm not playing that.
Yeah. That's sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think 7 years. Last night at a show I did, someone's like, oh, my 9 and 10-year-old nieces love your show. And I was like, that's bone chilling. I don't think that's good at all.
Nine and 10-year-olds, turn this off.
Yes.
But we can lose a couple of listeners.
Some awesome murderinos that were also backstage. One of the guys, I'm sorry, I can't remember your name. He goes, that's around the time I started getting interested in true crime. And then I was like, oh, okay. Okay, then. I don't feel as bad.
That's true, I guess, right?
Yeah, I think for me, it was sixth grade. So, yeah. You know, kids are very advanced.
And it's like even though it's not true crime, it's like the revving up of it. The things you're suddenly really interested in, like scary movies and bad things. And actually, speaking of children, so this girl named Sarah_Hall tweeted at us a photo of her 9-year-old sister, and she said she just named her own bat. She, I guess, was in baseball. She just named her own bat Ted Bundy all on her own.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's fucking incredible.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
I mean, Georgia so loves a pun.
I love a pun, and I love a 9-year-old, you know, and I love baseball.
I mean, it's everything you love.
Love everything.
If only that little girl had a vintage dress on while she did that.
Lose my mind.
Later. Well, I got a tweet that I found very interesting, and this is the kind of, you know, conversations that we like to have. It was the Coastal Horizons Rape Crisis Center in Wilmington, North Carolina,
yes,
sent a tweet. So they basically said, hey, ladies, big fans of your podcast. However, we were disappointed to hear the unintentional victim blaming that took place on the 2020 episode covering your drinks. The onus is never on the victim to stop an assault. We need to have a culture shift where instead of telling victims what to do or not to do, tell perps, hey, don't rape people.
Yes.
Also, alcohol is the number one drug used to facilitate sexual assault, not roofies. In parentheses, not saying it doesn't happen, but misinformation can unintentionally compound victims' trauma. We are a rape crisis center in Wilmington, North Carolina, and we frequently hear victims blaming themselves because they, quote, did everything right, my friend watched my drink, etc., and they are still assaulted. So just wanted to let you all know, love your work. Which I think is such a good point.
Totally.
We obviously, and we don't, it's not like we need to make excuses, but when we were having that conversation, we were coming from that point of view, which is very, for me, it's very 80s of like, you have to
be on the lookout at all times, kind of a
yeah,
thing.
Be on the defense, yeah, and kind of like be aggressively, you know, aware and all that kind of stuff. But it's such a good point that it doesn't matter. You can be the most aware. You can be the most, you know, responsible, all these things, and then something can happen to you.
Yeah.
And we never want people to feel like in any way, obviously, that would be our messaging. So
or that they're to blame, because that hurt me so much and made me sad of like they come in there and feel to blame. Maybe they didn't cover their drink like we're telling them to do. Or but the fact that she said it's usually alcohol, not. It's just alcohol. It's not like they need to roofie you to take advantage or to assault you.
Yeah, exactly. It's really actually a very common thing that people use all the time that doesn't make anybody feel that worried in the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's the, yeah. I think also we were having that conversation because it was around the time that girl, it was that thing that happened in Santa Monica where these women saw a guy put a drug into a girl's drink and they basically went and got her in the bathroom and were like, we just saw this thing. So we were kind of going off of that in a way, but you know, thank you for the correction because that's a really good point. And that really is, you know, please raise your sons not to rape. That would be great.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Did you see the trailer for the movie My Friend Dahmer?
Yes.
Holy shit.
Oh my God.
We're not being paid.
We're not being paid. We should be.
I want to see it today.
I know.
It looks so great.
It looks so good. I love that there's not, it doesn't seem like there's anything about him being an older person and actually committing. Is there? That's not what the book's about.
I don't think it is because I feel like I did read that comic yeah. book, the graphic novel.
Right.
But I can't remember the end. I mean, it's just the story of him, but I think it's him in high school and yeah. like basically when it all started.
I think it's going on the idea that you already know who Dahmer is and what he's done. And then, so while 100%. You're watching the movie, you're like, oh, this is a thing that made it happen. This is a thing that started it. And
it's kind of, teenage Dahmer.
Yeah.
Yes.
It looks so creepy and so eerie and...
It's really ominous. They're the very one of the first shots in that
yeah.
trailer is kind of a wide of the front of a school. And it's just kids in kind of like late 70s clothing walking around. And then you just notice there's a guy just standing there staring. And it's really fucking creepy.
It almost looks like if Napoleon Dynamite was like a scary movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly fucking right. If you change the soundtrack to Napoleon yes. Dynamite.
Which I love when people, I love those. I love like the Mrs. Doubtfire as a horror movie. Have yes. you seen that one?
Yo, yeah.
I fucking love those.
Or The Shining as a rom-com.
Totally.
Or like a family sitcom.
Totally. Or like a coming together. What's that song? Da 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 da. I'm oh, coming home.
Is it Shakira? Were you singing Shakira?
Probably.
Hips Don't Lie.
Yes.
YMCA.
Steven.
I think it's the Salisbury, the yes. Peter Gabriel song.
Oh.
Salisbury Hill.
Yes.
Something like that.
Salisbury Hill.
Salisbury
yeah.
Hills. Okay. Because mm-hmm. I thought saying Salisbury was clearly going to be wrong, so I didn't say it.
You were scared to risk it.
Yeah.
I see.
Steak.
Got you.
Salisbury steak and all that.
You know that beautiful Peter Gabriel song? Going up on Salisbury steak. I love that song. It's so like, there's those weird, I don't know what instrument it is, but it's like, poo, 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 poo. It's all yeah. like, oh. Hoo, hoo,
hoo. Like he's blowing into a windpipe. Is that a thing? Or like, what was the ones you had to play it as a kid?
A recorder.
I love Peter Gabriel.
There might be a recorder solo at the beginning of Salisbury Hill.
Salisbury Steak.
Salisbury Steak.
All of that is misinformation. That entirety of misinformation.
Wait, what were we talking about?
Jeffrey Dahmer.
Fucking
Napoleon
really,
Dynamite.
If you're an editor, if
yes.
you have the time,
yes.
if you care, could you please make Napoleon Dynamite into
I bet
into
you
a scary
take,
movie with a soundtrack.
I bet you could take the like trailer from Napoleon Dynamite, just put all of this, the exact same like voiceover and words from the trailer for Dahmer, just. Put him in there.
So, yeah. So it's like Napoleon Dynamite's mouth is moving in yeah. that weird, like his braces are still on, but they're not.
Mash it up. His
oh
friend,
my
his
God.
Friend is, his friend.
Pedro?
Pedro is the friend who wrote the book. Like, it's just perfect.
It's perfect. Did you plan this?
Yes, it's all written down.
Oh, is it?
Let me no, see. No, it's not.
Let me see those notes.
Oh, man. Nothing I say is ever planned, obviously. I never plan anything.
We absolutely assure you that, almost nothing is pre-written on this show.
No.
Even the things that are supposed to be.
Yeah, like our stories.
I think that's all I had. Did you have anything else?
I'm sure I can. I have other things that I just can't think of. And I keep writing things that I don't know. Like, I'll be like, oh, I should make a note for pre-show. And then I don't know what it means. So I have Yan Can Cook written down.
Yan Can Cook, I feel like, is from when we were talking.
I was watching it the other night, and then I was like, I gotta talk to Karen about this. I don't remember why I would talk to you about, on a murder podcast about Yan Can Cook.
Because that guy fucking murders chicken.
That guy's the best. Then I wrote embarrassing illness. I don't mm-hmm. know what that means.
That's probably Crohn's disease.
Yeah, and then I wrote stardust equals anxiety.
Do you mean angel dust?
I don't know. And I was like, I think I wrote something wrong, and I was like, I'll remember.
Were you on drugs or drink?
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Yes to all.
Yes. Always.
Well, how do we figure any of those things out? You just take some time with it?
No, I don't think we need to. I think as long as I say them.
Okay.
And then everyone out there. Knows.
Then if we're standing somewhere and a Yan Can Cook whatever comes by, we're
right.
both going to be like, this is what it is.
Yeah. And stardust equals anxiety is probably something really interesting.
Well, there's a movie called Stardust.
Is there?
Yeah.
I don't know, but why
Stardust
would
Stardust Memories is a Woody Allen movie.
No.
He would give you agita if you were.
Yeah. No, it's not that. Mm-hmm. I haven't watched that.
Okay.
Anxiety.
Is it that we're all made of stardust and that makes you worried?
I think it's that. Yeah. I think it's that. I think it's that I get anxious when I think of the entirety of the universe, but
oh,
I don't
yeah.
know how that has to do anything with murder.
Well, we talked about that one time.
We did.
Yes. Because I said, oh, it was when I said, did you see that picture from the Hubble telescope that showed universes and balls of gas?
Yeah.
And then you were like, please don't do this to me.
So I must have wanted to elaborate on that. And I was on drink.
Do you think there's a movie or something called Stardust that you saw as a child and that you discovered why it gives you so much anxiety?
I don't know.
I feel like generally trying to figure out worries is fascinating podcasting.
Like, what are you worried? Isn't there a podcast like
I'm
that?
Being sarcastic.
Oh. I got excited.
Isn't there already a podcast like that?
I think there is, though.
Oh, I think I'm worried about the universe. I can't remember how, though.
Yeah, I just am. I don't need to explain why. Everyone gets it.
Sure.
I hope.
Well, you need to explain why if you bring it up.
Yeah.
That's really the only thing.
And I did. Stardust gives me anxiety.
That's not an explanation.
The enormity of the universe gives me anxiety.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
Okay.
Should we
do this?
Yeah, I mean, I want to ask Steven who's going, but he's not trustworthy.
Steven just told me that he keeps getting it wrong, which
I
sucks
know.
Because I'm like, well, Steven knows.
Oh, no, he doesn't.
I'm no longer a rock.
You were attacked by that Twitter account who was like, Steven, get it together. Oh. You've been wrong three times in a row.
Shut up.
You know what it is? You know what I realized what it is my brain was doing to me was it's like, Karen, Georgia, Karen, like I'm doing that in my brain. So that's why I kept saying you would go first, because in my mind, Georgia went last time, but she went last
time. So you're not going, you're going Karen, Georgia.
Yes, but
instead
that's not.
Karen, Georgia, Georgia, Karen. Karen.
Yeah. I'm just, my brain completely just fell apart at that moment.
So what can we do to fix this going forward?
We have two things that people have made us of how to tell.
Twitter accounts?
No, remember the things they gave us at
live
shows?
But those are like a large abacus. Is Steven going to drive around with that in his car?
No, we can leave it here. Right?
I mean, it's your house.
Flip a coin or...
Do you think you have it this week?
It's Georgia, yeah.
Yes, I thought so too.
I really knew that.
Steven wouldn't fuck it up.
I want to rake him over the coals.
I needed
Steven,
it.
Steven, you have five chances. You've used three.
I just love the idea there's a Twitter account now attacking you because of the job.
What's it called again? Who went first last
who
week?
Who went first,
yeah. Well, there was... They were like... 5 days since accident or something like
that. Oh my God, I love it.
Because they were like keeping track and that was like this so many days funny. Since.
Oh, should I give Elvis isn't dead, everyone?
Yes, you should definitely give that up.
So last week I talked about how Elvis was at the vet and how scary it was. Turns out the kitten we got, Dottie, gave everyone a fucking crazy upper respiratory infection. I really truly thought Elvis was going to die and I had my cry and I, you know, apologized to him and held him in, like, truly. And he's better now. He's on the mend. He's not going to die, but he lost his voice.
Oh.
It's so cute. Before you leave, you have to see him open his mouth to meow and
nothing comes out.
Yeah, so maybe Dottie will have to do the sign off.
Did you see the fan art that people made of Elvis in front of a black background and it just says I survived on the side and then
Are
in quotes
you?
And it's the first time I saw it in quotes it says yeah so this kitten tried to kill me ... or something like that. The first time I saw it I almost had a heart attack. I was like, if she sees it, she's gonna fucking shit a brick, because he was still not out of the woods yet,
right?
And it was hilariously awful, where I was like, I think I'm gonna have to ask these people to take it down.
Oh well, right. Like, now I think I didn't see it. Oh my God, if he died ever. Yeah, so thank you
ever
to everyone. Everyone was so sweet and
yes,
you know, and said nice things and reassured me. And yeah, the vet was like, he's not gonna die, calm down. So
good.
Thanks, Village Vet.
Good update.
Yeah, all is well.
Positive update.
Hey,
there's something about the sound of an old-timey cash register that really takes me back.
I know. It sounds like someone is about to hand me an ice cream cone, but it also sounds like we just sold some merch.
That's right. And if you're a Shopify user like us, you know that this sound means you just made a sale.
Shopify has helped millions of businesses sell their products online, but did you know they also offer the same support for brick and mortar stores?
From accepting payments to managing inventory, they have everything you need to sell in person. So give your point of sale system a serious upgrade with Shopify.
Shopify POS tracks sales across all your locations. That way, you'll always know what you have in stock and where.
They also provide reliable tech that fits your unique retail needs, like turning a tablet into a credit card reader.
And if you're looking to reach new customers, check out Shopify's marketing tools. They're easy to use, and they integrate with all social media platforms.
With Shopify, we have a powerful partner for managing our sales. And if you're a business owner, you can too.
Do retail right with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period today at shopify.com/murder. And here's the important note, that promo code is all lowercase.
So go to shopify.com/murder and take your retail business to the next level.
That's shopify.com/murder. Again, don't forget, the code is all lowercase.
Goodbye.
Georgia, have you ever been blown away by the most simple dish at a restaurant, like perfectly scrambled eggs?
Oh my God, yes, Karen. And then all I want to do is make that dish at home and eat it every day.
Well, you probably could, as long as you have the chef's secret ingredient, Made In cookware.
Made In was created to bring restaurant quality performance kitchenware to home chefs around the world.
For years, they've built their business by supplying restaurants and top chefs with high-end cookware. Some of Tom Colicchio's most treasured dishes at his restaurant Kraft are made in Made In.
Whether you're cooking for professional critics or just the critics you live with, your meals will benefit from the quality of Made In products.
Like their carbon steel cookware, it combines the best of both cast iron and stainless steel clad, so it's rugged enough for grills or an open flame. It's the MVP of summer cookouts and cook-ins. What I really love about Made In cookware is that it actually makes something like having a Memorial Day barbecue much more convenient, because you can keep everything on the grill. If you need to throw, say, a pan of garlic up on the top while you're grilling your steaks on the bottom, it's strong enough, durable enough to do that.
If you want to take your cooking to the next level, remember what so many great dishes have in common. They're all Made In, Made In.
Save up to 25% this Memorial Day from May 18th through May 27th when you visit madeincookware.com.
That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com. Goodbye.
Okay, so I go first. I just forgot. All right. This is the story of the collar bomb heist.
Okay, awesome.
You don't know it?
I don't even really know what you just said.
Okay. It's the story of the collar. So a collar bomb, meaning like a collar around your neck. Collar bomb.
Is this a woman and her daughter?
No.
Okay.
Heist.
Okay.
And I just want to up top say that there is an article called in Wired by Rich Shapiro that has a really good overview of everything that happened. So I used a lot of his information, and I just wanted to give him props for that. And it happened, he wrote it in 2010. So there's a little bit of an update since then.
Great.
But so we're in Erie, Pennsylvania. I looked this up on my favorite murder email to see if anyone had talked about it. And it's from their town. And a girl named Jessica A. said, "The winters are terrible and the summers are filled with water sports on the lake and lots of drinking. In fact, you will find either a church or a bar at every corner."
Wow.
Which I think describes the town really well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. August 28th, 2003, at 2:28 p.m., a 46-year-old local man named Ryan Wells walks into a PNC bank in Erie and passes the teller a note. The note says, "Gather employees with your access with access codes to the vault and work fast to fill the this bag with $25,000. You only have 15 minutes." Then he lifts his shirt to show the teller a handcuff-like collar attached to his neck. And according to the note, it's a bomb.
Oh, fuck.
And the bomb's like a DIY homemade device. It's got a metal collar attached around Wells's neck, like a handcuff. And there are keyholes and a combination lock, as well as baking timers and 2 6-inch pipe bombs.
Oh. Baking timer.
Yeah.
You mean like the white ones that you turn that your mom's like, yeah, you have 5 minutes sitting out there.
I love that it's never used for banking. It's for fucking baking. It's for punishing your children.
Yes, exactly. Or just being like, oh, I have to do something in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Set nobody, that timer.
Nobody bakes.
That is okay. How disturbing. As you're that teller, you stayed up really late the night before drinking wine with your friends. You roll in, you're like, I'm gonna power through this day,
yeah,
and I'll be fine,
yeah,
because I'm gonna go out drinking with my friends again.
Yeah.
And a guy walks up I imagine sweating profusely.
Yeah. And like, if a guy walks up to you in your hotel room and passes you a note, you're like, fuck. It's not going to say like, hey, how are you? Nice. I lost my voice. I'm Elvis. I lost
Hi,
my
I'm
voice.
Elvis. I'm here to Ritz Blossom cookies.
Yeah.
And no. It's all bad. Always bad with a note.
Yeah.
Always bad with a guy that has to pull up his shirt to prove a point.
And he's like, clearly there's something bulging in his shirt collar.
Yeah.
And he has a shirt on.
His neck is really thick.
Yeah. It looks, I bet it would look like he has a tracheotomy.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of looked like that. And he has like two shirts on and the shirt over it. And the shirt says Guess. It's like a Guess brand shirt.
No.
Which just like fits the.
Are you being sarcastic?
I fucking swear to God. I fucking swear.
Okay, I'm going to stop hypothesizing and let you tell the story.
No, that's the show.
Just the visual of like that, but like the jerry-rigged baking timer. And then, but there was also a couple magnetic letters from his refrigerator. And I mean, you know what I mean? And a pipe cleaner and some old gum.
Yeah.
Yes. Stuck to the. Okay.
Yes.
Is it real? I don't know who the victim is. I don't know who's guilty. And I'm saying things like that.
Well, it's okay. Because here we go.
Okay.
So the teller is only able to give Brian $8,700 because there isn't a way to get into the vault at that time. Like there wasn't enough people there.
So the baking timer goes off.
And then you suddenly smell cookies. And Elvis is like second in line. Hey,
excuse me, those are mine. Pulls a cookie out of his neck handcuff.
Yeah.
And says, thanks for doing business with
me. But what he does do, and I'm not fucking kidding, he takes the money and leaves and he grabs a Dum Dum lollipop on his way out.
Oh.
Puts it in his mouth.
Okay. So he's not as stressed as maybe.
That's what you would think.
Okay.
Or he's really stressed and he needs something to occupy him.
Doubtful. Hey, I relate.
Doubtful though.
Well, I just feel like if you think you're about to blow up.
Yeah.
And look, I love candy. I don't think it would be.
You're not like, I'm going to blow up. Oh, dum-dums.
Oh my God. You know when you get these for Halloween, you get like 10 of them at a time.
You stuff them all in your mouth at once because then it's like a real lollipop.
I would just eat it fast and then use the stick as a cigarette.
Yes.
Just stand around fake smoking.
Look how good I look smoking.
Guys.
All right.
Maybe that guy needed a cigarette and he knew that was the closest.
That's what it is. And he was like, I probably can't smoke around a bomb. Those things probably don't go hand in hand.
There might be gasoline in this.
Definitely. I don't know how bombs are made. You pour gasoline on them? I don't know. About 15 minutes after he walks out, state troopers spot Brian Wells, that's his name, standing outside of his, guess what kind of car he has? If you get this right, I'm going to barf.
Is it a Le Mans?
No, what's that?
I don't know. It's like some kind of pseudo fancy car.
No, it's a Geo Metro.
Oh, remember those? Second only to the Yugo in bad cars.
It's for you young kids. It's just like the first hatchback and those aren't cool.
It's like a Fiat that gave up on itself.
It's like an 80s hatchback. But this is 2003. I don't know. So
wait, he had a Geo Metro in 2003.
Yeah.
Maybe he was an antique shitty car collector.
Do you know what he actually was?
What?
A pizza delivery man.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can see a pizza delivery man having that car.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the tires have absolutely no tread on them whatsoever.
Yeah. They're like all, what's the ones in the back?
Oh, like the replacement tires?
Yeah, they're all replacement tires.
They're all spares.
Yeah, they're all spares.
Four spares on a Geo Metro.
Yeah. I'm sorry we're making fun of this guy. But it'll be okay and you'll find out why.
Okay.
It's not, well, you'll find out why at the end. It actually gets really fucking bad.
Yeah, I bet it gets bad in the
middle. It gets really bad.
Okay.
So they apprehend him. They cup his hands behind his back. And then Brian says to them that while out on a pizza delivery, he had been attacked by a group of black men, because that's everyone's excuse, who chained the bomb around his neck at gunpoint and forced him to rob the bank.
Yep. That's how it's done.
He says, it's going to go off. I'm not lying. he's like desperate at this point. It's going to go off. I'm not fucking lying.
Can I just say one thing?
Yes, always.
My first agent in this business, who was a mastermind and a genius. One of the first pieces of advice she ever gave me was whatever people explicitly state to you without you asking them is a lie. Just immediately reverse it in your head. Of
like saying,
like if I went to a meeting at a management place and they were like, look, we don't just take whoever and like throw it all against the wall and see what happens. It's like, oh, you just take whoever and throw it. Is that kind of thing where you just have to kind of, why would you proclaim this to me if it were true?
And I didn't even ask you.
Yeah, exactly.
Or say, I'm not lying.
Yes.
That means I'm lying.
Why would you need to tell people that if you have a live bomb on your body or that just happened to you.
I feel like probably sociopaths say I'm not lying a lot because they don't expect people to believe. They don't expect people to be smart enough to be like, I know that that's a line that people say to get them, like, and they just don't think anyone's smart.
That's true. I would think that they would be the kind of people who wouldn't. Saying I'm not lying is almost just like a try. And I don't think they try very much.
Or
I think
they know
just
the
like
tells.
So balls out. Yeah, that they're just like, I'm not nervous, therefore you're never going to ask me a question in the first place.
Right. And that's if you ask me, I'm going to tell you. Yeah, okay, you're going to believe me. All right, I'm not lying. So the officers call the bomb squad and they take their positions behind their cars. Their guns are drawn and they leave Brian sitting in the middle of the street, cross-legged, handcuffed behind his back with his bomb around his neck, and he's in the middle of the road just sitting there. And okay, there's a video of all this, and okay, I'll tell you in a second.
Okay,
for 25 minutes while news people are filming there,
he's laying in the street,
he's sitting cross-legged in the street,
okay,
kind of like slumped in the street, he's kind of fidgeting and stuff. So they're sitting there for 25 minutes, then out of nowhere the device starts to beep. Beep, beep. And you see him, it's all on video. You see him kind of look down and start to struggle, like he's trying to get away from the caller. And then it fucking goes off.
No.
Yeah.
And no.
The video, there is video on this, and they don't warn you that they're about to show it. And so I saw it and I got really, and having to look this up and look at video and news stuff, I just kept having to turn my head away because it's so awful. And
that's
he fucking
horrifying.
Dies.
That's horrifying.
So you know this guy dies, and you see this bomb go off, and people are probably watching it live and see this happen.
Fuck. I'm so surprised.
Yeah.
Okay.
He looked surprised too that it was even going off, meaning I don't think he thought it was real. And it detonates, loud explosion, blowing into his face. He falls back onto the ground. He dies almost instantly, I believe. The bomb had ripped a huge hole in his chest. Ugh. 3 minutes later, bomb squad arrives.
Oh, no.
I know. So the police search his car and they find handwritten notes that were addressed to the bomb hostage. And they say that one of them says, there's only one way you can survive, and that is to cooperate completely. This powerful booby-trapped bomb can be removed only by following our instructions. Act now, think later, or you will die.
Sorry, handwritten notes to this guy?
Yeah, so okay, it's basically they're handwritten notes to the guy, to Brian.
I thought that meant his handwritten
note. No, okay. Yeah, someone else had written these notes to him. They were in his car.
Okay.
So the police had caught him. It was almost like a scavenger hunt, but he had to rob the bank, then go to these certain places to get the keys, give them the money, that sort of thing.
Right.
So, but police had caught him in the middle of the scavenger hunt. So they tried to finish the scavenger hunt themselves and find the notes, but someone had removed the remaining notes after Brian had been killed. So they found the places where they were supposed to be, but there wasn't anything else there.
And sorry, was that like the video you watched or whatever, was that shown live on the news?
It had to have been because people were talking about having watched it.
Fuck.
Yeah. Sitting there with their kids,
so
probably
horrible.
And it was at like 3 o'clock something, so there must have been kids after school watching that.
100%.
How traumatized are those children?
It's the worst.
I watched it and I am a little fucked up from it.
No, you can't, like, yeah, it's that kind of shit. You have to be so, so careful
and prepared for.
Yeah.
All right. They trace Brian's last pizza delivery on the day of his death, which is when he said he got attacked. They found that his last order was to be delivered on the outskirts of the city ended up being a TV transmission tower where the address was.
Mm-hmm.
And they could tell by the scuff marks in the dirt that that's where the caller had been attached. But he was supposed to be off right before that call came in to order the pizzas, which was kind of mysterious. All right. Then cut to September 20th, less than a month after the bomb killed Brian. 59-year-old Bill Rothstein, who was a handyman and lifelong resident in the area, calls 911. He gave the operator his address and told him that there was a frozen body in his garage freezer.
What?
Yeah. He told him that the story was that in mid-August, his ex-girlfriend, Marjorie Deal Armstrong, had called him and told him she had shot her live-in boyfriend, James Roden, in the back with a Remington 12-gauge shotgun in a dispute over money. And then she asked him to help her clean up and move the body, which he agreed to. And so the body had been in his freezer for 5 weeks. He also melted down the gun and scattered the pieces around the county.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thorough. How do you melt down a gun?
I don't even fucking know. Power tools? I think he was a
double
handyman.
Boiler?
Yeah. He's a handyman, so he probably knows a lot about.
He had some fucking welding thing
exactly.
or whatever.
Shit. Probably put some, like, I don't know. You know there's some powder you can probably put on something to make it flammable.
Oh, I think I've seen things where if you put Diet Coke on a piece of meat.
Oh, why do I stop it? I got so excited. Isn't that a thing?
It is. But I'm sure it doesn't melt guns. I'm almost positive.
Let's try it.
Let's see.
Steven, get your gun out. Just shoots both of us. Wouldn't that be hilarious? They told me. I have it on tape.
It's such a weird ending to that podcast because everyone liked Steven.
Now we're
but
all
it
wondering.
Turns out he really didn't like those girls.
But is it just fictional, the whole podcast? Now we have to go back and listen again.
The whole thing was a play.
And we have to write down all the times we yelled at Steven.
Slowly building the rage in Steven.
And you can hear him breathing in the background harder and harder every week.
Meanwhile, he has both hands over his face laughing. He's like a little...
bright red.
Little Japanese girl. Just giggling.
Steven. Okay, so he tells them he just couldn't go with the final plan, which was to grind the body up. So he called 911. He was afraid of what she might do to him. So he says he was so distraught that he had even considered killing himself rather than turning himself in. And he had written a suicide note in which he said who the body was in the freezer. When he didn't kill him, it says, nor participate in the death. And then the note ended with, this has nothing to do with the Wells case.
Oh, no.
For no reason, says that in the note. Because he lived behind the TV transmission spot.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Okay, now look at my theory, how it's been completely reversed right in my face.
Which is what now?
It's the first guy going, the victim, mm-hmm. saying, I'm not lying. Mm-hmm. And my theory is, that's because he's lying. Mm-hmm. Well, then this guy mm-hmm. saying, this has nothing to do with it.
Out of nowhere. Like, he hadn't even been questioned about it.
Yeah, don't bring it up.
No. But BTW. No.
So, obviously, what my research reveals is that there's no hard and fast rule about right. statements.
Or is there?
Or
we are not done yet.
Oh, shit.
Twists and turns all over that place. They made the movie 30 minutes or less.
Yes.
That came out like 2011.
My friend Ruben Fleischer directed that.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, they think it's like loosely based on this. So there'll be twists and turns.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Don't worry.
Okay.
I haven't seen it, so I don't really know. But all right. So here's a little bit about Marjorie, the woman who killed her boyfriend. So in 1994, she's 35. She's charged with murdering her then boyfriend, Robert Thomas. Rob Thomas, isn't he from Matchbox 20?
Yeah.
That just hit me. She claims she shot him 6 times in self-defense. As you know how you shoot someone 6 times in self-defense?
Yes. Well, just to really finish it off.
Just to kill
the
shit out of them.
She's very OCD. She wanted to finish all the bullets in the gun.
Right.
Sorry, this is the same woman who had the body in the freezer?
Yeah. This is the body in the freezer woman.
This is a different relationship.
Yes.
Okay.
Years before.
Okay.
A jury acquits her. And then 4 years later, her husband, Richard Armstrong, dies of a cerebral hemorrhage. Nope.
Hemorrhage.
Jesus. Those two words together can't. Cerebral hemorrhage.
Yeah.
But when he got to the hospital, he had a head injury, but the death is still ruled accidental and never followed up with by the coroner. Which head injuries and cerebral hemorrhaging don't go. That's not a thing.
They
right.
They don't go together?
No.
Yeah, yeah. Cerebral hemorrhaging means your brain is bleeding, which means someone hit you really fucking hard on the head or something.
Doesn't hemorrhaging just happen, though, too? Like the way when people have a stroke or something like that?
Oh, I do. I feel...
Look and listen. Neither of us are going to claim we're right.
My assumption as a doctor is... I just think hemorrhaging can happen in any kind of a way. It's not specific to just like an aneurysm.
Right.
An aneurysm is when you're like a vessel in your brain explodes and then usually you die.
Okay. So yeah, hemorrhaging. That sounds right. Okay.
Please, doctors.
Yes.
Please tell us how to do this podcast.
The best way to let us know about something is to scream at us on Twitter. I just want everyone to know that's the only time we listen.
That's right.
Is screaming on
with
Twitter.
With our hearts.
We're doctors. Let's see. death is ruled accidental. So Marjorie is extremely smart, but she suffers from bipolar disorder and she's found to be paranoid and narcissistic. In 1984, they found 400 pounds of butter and more than 700 pounds of cheese rotting inside her house. This is from the Wired article.
What's up?
Can I repeat this?
Please.
So I think she was a hoarder. So 400 pounds of butter. How much is that?
It's so much. Well, a pound of butter is the 4 cubes.
Okay. That's a pound of butter. So
she had 400
of those. And 700 pounds of cheese.
Robbing. I mean, that's just a dream come true.
What kind of cheese? If we're talking about fucking Kraft singles,
it's
I'm
Velveeta.
Out.
If she had it stored somewhere, it's Velveeta because you can leave that like in a warm room for 2 years and nothing will happen.
It's plastic. Could I tell you what Vince made me for dinner last night? Because I was like, oh, I forgot to tell you this too. Damn it.
You go.
Can I get on a gross food tangent real
Please.
Quick? Okay. So last night, Vince brought home, he did the thing of, I've been craving this thing from childhood, and I was like playing along, like, I'll try it with you, baby. So he made me a bologna and American cheese sandwich on white bread.
Yes.
With mustard.
I used to have them every single day for
It
school.
Was great. We never had, like, we never got to have any of that good stuff.
Yeah.
So I had
nitrates.
Sometimes he'll fry up the bologna.
Wow.
I know. But what happened, and this is just, I'm explaining who Vince is. On like Saturday, I picked him up after a thing and we were both hungry and I was like, where should we go? And I always am like, no, I don't want to go there. And like, we go where I want to go. But he was like, this place, or this place. And I was like, okay, baby, you pick which. I was being nice. Like, I'm just trying to not be a fucking asshole anymore.
Good. Yeah. Put in that effort.
Yeah. Yep. So we went to the Olive Garden for brunch on Saturday. How do you feel about that?
All I see is like a bunch of Italian spices mixed into shit that I don't want there. That's the first thing I think of.
You are 100% correct. They had a thing called an Italian margarita. He ordered it. The guy at the bar was just like such a sassy, funny person. And he put it in front of he put a margarita in front of him. And then he put down a little like shot glass of amaretto. And he goes, that's what makes it Italian. I was just like, oh, I love you. It was so great. But they have a nice little soup and salad deal. Anyways, at the
bottomless
end.
Bottomless breadsticks, right?
Yeah.
Come on.
The salad's actually good. On the way out, a girl stops me and she goes, don't I know you? And I did the, oh, searching for my brain. And she goes, just kidding. I'm a huge fan. So she was a waitress there. And she was just like, really cool.
Great.
That's it.
Okay.
I got recognized at the Olive Garden because I was at the Olive Garden.
Hell yes.
All right.
Because when you're there, you're family.
I was family.
Nice.
So thank
you.
Wait.
Don't I recognize? You're my aunt.
Yeah.
Oh, hi.
Oh my God. Hi.
Nice to see you.
Aunt Carol. Oh, all right. 700 pounds of cheese rotting inside her house.
Fuck. Okay. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yes.
Because you can't even get that from a store. It's not like you can go to an Indivance or whatever your local chain is called and be like, that's all the butter that they have for the month, essentially.
Yeah. And they, yeah.
What's she doing? Do you know how she got it?
No.
Okay.
Nothing about it. It's rotting.
Okay.
Can you imagine the smell? Like, does butter even rot?
It does. Like, it turns, but it takes a long time.
Yeah. Like, you can leave it out on the counter and it won't go bad for a while.
I mean.
We always refrigerate our butter, which I hate. Cold butter?
You can put it on a plate as long as it's covered on the counter.
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
I don't fucking know. Someone is dead.
Many people are.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So I wrote so in capital because I think I knew we were going to go on this tangent. So back to it. Okay. In fact, when preparing to be tried in the shooting death of her first ex, psychiatrists deemed her mentally incompetent 7 times before they finally ruled she was allowed to be tried, which I feel like 7 times means you are not ever going to be mentally. And that's such a hard thing to do because everyone's like, I'm mentally ill. That's why I killed this person.
Oh, trying to get out of it.
Yeah. And they're like, bullshit.
But sorry, they kept on saying she was mentally incompetent and couldn't stand trial. And then they finally were like, wait, no, on the 8th time she is.
Yeah, she's better now.
Oh, got it.
No, but yeah, that's ridiculous.
Got it.
So I wrote, so on September 21st of 2003, Marjorie Deal Armstrong is arrested for the murder of her most recent ex, the freezer guy, James Roden.
Okay.
She pleads guilty but mentally ill, but she's still sentenced to 7 to 20 years in state prison for that murder. 3 months after she goes to prison in April of 2005, So I might have the dates wrong. Federal agents investigating the collar bomb mystery. They're still like, what the fuck happened? The handwriting analysis of the fucking notes are baffled. They just don't understand why this scavenger hunt was part of it. It doesn't make any sense to them.
Okay.
They are called from the state police officer who has just met with Marjorie in prison. She tells them that the murder of her most recent ex-boyfriend actually had nothing to do with money, but instead was part of the collar bomb plot. So they didn't even know she was involved at this point.
She just came forward with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
She's like,
can I just exchange that piece of information for a stick of butter? I just want to put it under my pillow.
They only have margarine here.
It's driving me disgusting. Insane. I need some rotten butter.
What she actually wants besides just butter is a transfer from the state pen where she's in to a minimum security spot much closer to Erie. And if they do that, she'll tell them everything she knows. So she begins by telling them that she was not, of course, I'm not involved in any way in the plot, but she admits that she knew about it and that she supplied the kitchen timers. So she's the baker or the punisher of children.
When they were trying to fingerprint that kitchen timer, they were just like, there's no fingerprints, but it is coated in butter. There's like so much butter all over it.
We need to find the butter culprit.
The butter bomber.
Butter bomber. It's even better. Butter. She tells them that the actual mastermind behind the whole plot was Bill Rothstein, the dude who lived behind the TV tower who turned her in for murder. But Bill Rothstein had died of lymphoma about a year earlier in July 2004, so they can't fucking question him. She also tells the feds that Brian Williams wasn't just the victim, but had been in on the planning from the beginning.
The guy that actually blew up in the bomb?
Yeah.
Okay.
Twists and turns.
Keep talking.
So he did, when he said, I'm not lying, he was lying. You were right.
Oh, thank God.
That's why I was like, hold up.
That theory was right twice.
Yes.
Nice.
Okay. So according to Marjorie, Brian Wells, the victim, had agreed to rob the bank wearing what he thought was a fake collar bomb. The scavenger hunt, he was told, was simply a ruse to fool the cops. If he got caught, he could say like, well, look at these instructions as evidence that he was only following orders. But at some point, Brian Wells, and you don't hear this phrase very often, is double-crossed.
Yes.
The fake bomb is switched out to be a real one, which he didn't know until it was strapped to his neck. They held him down at gunpoint. Because when he got to the TV station with the pizzas, he realized it was real and tried to run, and they grabbed him and held him down at gunpoint.
Okay, wait. So did he not know? Is it Marjorie?
Yeah.
Marjorie and the guy that died of lymphoma.
Yeah.
Rothstein. He didn't know them before?
He knew them. He thought they had all planned this thing and agreeing that it was going to be a fake bomb.
So he drove there as if it's like, I'm delivering pizzas to this place.
Right. The whole thing is him being tricked. He was in on that thinking it'd be a fake bomb.
Got it.
They are like, it's a real bomb. Get over here.
And it all falls together because then that fucking dum-dums part makes perfect sense.
Right.
Okay.
And I think even when thinking about the dum-dum, the way he panicked when the beeping went off is he didn't even know that it was fake until the beeping went off. That's what I think.
Yes.
Because
you mean that it was real?
Yeah. Because even him saying, I'm not lying, he's lying.
Yeah.
He thinks it's not real. And I think they're telling him this. I don't know why she's telling him this, but I don't believe that. So what? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So, they strap it to his neck at gunpoint. The FBI had already concluded they had checked out the bomb and that it was rigged. So at any attempt to remove it at all, it would have set it off. So he was destined. He was going to die no matter what. Then in late 2005, a few months after Marjorie first talked to the feds, a witness comes forward and says that an ex-television repairman turned crack dealer named Kenneth Barnes was also involved. Barnes was already in jail on unrelated drug charges. So when threatened with more time behind bars, he agrees to a deal. He would give the full account, blah, 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 reduced sentence. He confirms that Marjorie was, he says, which is what other people were coming forward and saying, Marjorie was the mastermind behind the collar bomb plot. He claims she needed the cash so she could pay him to kill her father for inheritance money.
Jesus Christ.
I know. In Erie, Pennsylvania.
She's like a black widow.
Yeah. So he's sentenced, Barnes is sentenced to 45 years behind bars, but he agrees to testify against Marjorie. He also explains Brian Wells' reasoning why he even got in on the plot for money. He needed the money because he had developed a relationship with a sex worker, and he had devised a scheme where he was like, I'm going to sell crack because I need the money to be with her. I think he was like in love with her. But he had fallen into debt with the crack dealers. So he needed to pay them off.
Okay, so he's like the most romantic crack dealer of all time.
Yeah, it's for love, which is like so sweet. And in one of the articles, it's like he was a drug dealer. And it's like, well, he wasn't. When you call him a drug dealer, you're not, you know, explaining the intricacies, which sounds like a fucking movie.
Look, if you're selling crack to people, you're a drug dealer. It doesn't matter what your motives are.
You're right. You're correct.
You can be a cold-hearted snake, or you can be...
You are correct.
You could be the most nicest romantic person.
If you're selling drugs.
Because also, it's not like, oh, he's selling pot, so he's getting $60 a hit. He's like probably making fucking bank.
And these people who are crackheads or crack addicts are ruining their lives. So he's helping them ruin their lives.
Yes, exactly. You are. Aiding and abetting. And then also on top of that, so that he can fuck a lady who probably doesn't give a shit one way or the other about him.
Right. Otherwise, she wouldn't be charging him, probably.
One would like to think that it would go into a Julia Roberts in that movie kind of direction.
Right.
Where she then does actually kiss him on the mouth.
Oh, my God. Why am I being romantic about this?
Well, you probably got involved in your reading. And I'm counterpointing.
I just want to know Brian Wells more. Like, I feel he probably wasn't the sharpest needle in the tack. I knew I wasn't going to get that right, so I just kept going with it. You know what I mean?
That was like a straight up Yogi Berra style quote.
Just
like,
I took all of the things.
Calling someone else dumb by
<You're totally right. laughs>
mixing your metaphors.
Oh, man. I don't know. To me, he lost the most.
He's
of the
not
story.
Some mastermind. He's not like.
Yeah, he got duped pretty hard for a reason that, you know, he didn't understand was okay. Da, 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 da. He also testified that Marjorie's ex, whose body was the freezer body, was also in on the crime. The reason he had been killed was because he threatened to tell the feds, not because of money.
Oh, wow.
So that's why his freezer body happened.
Okay.
When Marjorie took the stand around trial, she's fucking ranting and raving. She's like, she's bananas.
She's butter crazy.
She's butter crazy. She claims to have never met Brian Wells, the victim, even though he testified that she had even measured his neck for the collar bomb.
Oh.
The jury didn't believe her. She's voted guilty of armed robbery. I wrote it voted guilty, and I'm like, I'll figure that out once we're there. So I just read it off the paper.
I mean, technically, you're right.
Voted guilty. Guilty of armed bank robbery conspiracy using a destructive device in a crime of violence. She died on April of this year, actually, as 86 years old of natural causes.
86?
Yeah,
shit.
So she died in 2017 in April.
Whoa.
Yeah, when we were just hanging out, thinking anything was whatever, and then she's dying. All right, last part, and this is also from Wired. Retired FBI criminal investigators, who you know are the fucking coolest people in the world, I want to have a drink with him. Jim Fisher, this guy, thinks that there's no way that Marjorie planned the collar bomb heist. He, based on the FBI suspect profile, which they had before anyone got in trouble for this, he thinks Bill Rothstein was the mastermind. He was a handyman with the skills to create a homemade bomb. And it wasn't about money, he thinks. He had never accomplished much in his life. He wanted to show how brilliant he was by, quote, executing a crime that would grab headlines across the globe and baffle authorities for years. He recruited conspirators he knew he could control and kept crucial details of the plot from them, a tactic designed to further complicate the investigation.
Wow.
So he thinks he was just fucking with his head. Like, it kind of reminded me of the guy from S-Town that they...
I still haven't listened to it.
Well, people who have listened to S-Town, this guy was like this brilliant dude.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of that. In the end, says Jim Fisher, the son of a bitch ended up winning.
Huh. Well, not so much because I'd never heard of this case before.
Yeah.
But he won. I mean, we are talking about it now.
He won by dying a free man.
Yes, that's true.
You know? And baffling the shit, and they still don't really understand how and what happened.
Which isn't a victory, because that just means you went crazy, you victimized a bunch of people, and it doesn't make sense why you did it.
Yeah.
That's not like to your genius credit.
No, that's I think that's
fucked up.
What he specifically wanted, which again is not a genius move. It's like
for me, like the kitchen timer right there proves that he's not a genius.
Yeah.
Like get one of those LED digital readout timers or get the fuck out of town.
Well, I think what he wanted to prove is he could fucking make a bomb in his whatever garage out of anything. You know, those people who like to take things apart and put them back together just to see how they work instead of reading a fucking book and just chilling out, take a nap.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Well, that was fascinating.
Yeah, wasn't it? And the, I'd say look at the picture of him sitting in the middle of the road.
Go nowhere near the video of him getting blown up.
In fact, I want you to see the picture, kind of. Steven, can you pull that up? Just to see. It's just this, like, clear afternoon news story.
Okay.
Of him sitting there. They're not too close.
I can totally picture it.
He looks almost like a mannequin sitting there.
Oh.
It's just like this still body. Not dead. I'm talking about when he's...
He was just waiting.
Yeah.
So was that the whole bomb squad thing? They were just waiting for the bomb squad to show up.
Yeah.
That's what he was just sitting on the curb.
And they were calling the bomb squad, but also they weren't sure if he was even in on it. So they had his, their guns drawn on him. Yeah. That one. Go look up the picture, everyone. Yeah, it's like a bummer, obviously. It looks like when someone gets stopped at a traffic thing and then they go to arrest him.
Yeah.
It looks like that.
Like he's an unruly drunk driver.
Yeah.
What's that? Do you know what his shirt says or what that
says? Guess.
Oh, that's the guess thing.
Yeah. And they think that's part of it. It's like Bill Rothstein put a shirt on him that says guess.
That's fucked up.
I know.
Wow, that's a good one.
Thank you. It's so weird because I saw this, like, it was from 2003. I think I saw maybe a City Confidential or a 2020, like, pretty immediately after it happened. So no one still knew what was going on. And it just stuck with me. And it was one of those ones where I was like, everyone knows this one, so I'm not going to do it. And then I was like, well, maybe they don't. So,
I mean, the one I thought it was There's an I Survived about a woman who gets home invaded. It's her and her daughter.
Right.
And they put a bomb on her and make her go rob a bank. Right. And they're like, if you say anything, it's the same exact thing. But she really was, you know, she was a victim and survived it. They ended up getting off her. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Phew.
I know.
Well, I think you're first this time, this week.
If you're like me, you're always looking for a story to dive into. Whether it's a family drama or a mystery to solve, the key to getting hooked is the details. I need rich visuals and intricate storylines, and June's Journey has that and more. June's Journey is a mobile mystery game that follows June Parker, a daring young woman, on a quest to uncover the truth about her sister's murder. This is your chance to test your detective skills because you'll play the game as June herself. Explore beautifully designed scenes from the 1920s, like lavish estates and gardens, and don't forget to keep an eye out for hidden clues. There are twists, turns, and catchy tunes, all leading you deeper into the thrilling storyline. And if you play well enough, you could make it to the Detective Club. There, you'll chat with other players and compete with or against them. June needs your help, but watch out, you never know which character might be a villain. Shocking family secrets will be revealed, but will you crack the case? Find out as you escape this world and dive into June's world of mystery, murder, and romance. It's all just one tap away. Discover your inner detective when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. That's June's Journey. Download the game for free on iOS and Android. Goodbye.
Okay, my turn.
Let's do it.
I don't know what that voice was. This story is, I've been trying to do it for a really long time. Because I've been reading an Anne Rule book about this serial killer. But then I think Frank ate the back half of the book. It turned into a thing where then I was trying to find the book again and whatever.
I think we should make, for new listeners, Frank is her dog. It's not her boyfriend.
That's
who's
right.
Fucking eating the back of her book.
I have a really nervous boyfriend named Frank.
He doesn't like when I learn things.
He doesn't like when I leave the house. But the first chapter of this book is one of the most hook you in and you can't stop reading chapters. It's Anne Rule. So
I know. I've been meaning to read a new one by her.
This is a great one. I had bought one at the airport on the last tour that was it was a bunch of different stories kind of all put together.
Nice.
But I realized that, like, that's a little bit too depressing because it's just almost like the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, and I like her thoughts on it and stuff.
Yeah, I think I enjoy, like, the full thing more. But the cool thing about Anne Rule is that she just goes so far into the victims' lives. So you get all that information. So if this is an interesting story to you, Anne Rule wrote a book called Lust Killer, and it's about this guy. But this is the best part. So I texted Steven yesterday. I was like, can you please get me a chronology of this guy so that I can get ahead on this story? And so he looked up and found this chronology that was put together by some people in the Department of Psychology at Radford University in Radford, Virginia. And those people are Mike Keefe, Audrey Mangrum. I was going to say Magnum. Audrey Mangrum, Kimberly Mast, Heather McGinn, Ryan Miller, Kristen Pushaw, Nicole Newsom, and Vicky Tanner.
A lot of ladies.
So many ladies.
Fuck yeah.
It doesn't say if they are like students. It doesn't right. say who they are in the department or whatever, but they put together, it's like an Excel spreadsheet
yeah.
of the years and then the significant like moments in this guy's life.
Nice.
Which is a lifesaver yeah. for doing a show like this.
I need that.
Yeah.
So many times.
We need it every GD yeah. week.
And then said you have to read 1,800 articles to find that.
Yeah.
Which is fine and
it's
fun.
It's good. But then yeah. when you have a spine like this, these guys did yeah. amazing work. Really good. It's just very great detail work where sometimes when you're reading a story, if you read two articles, the second one contradicts the first one.
Right.
Then you're like, well, did he join the army or not? Like, it's yeah. that thing.
I always am like, well, the first one said this, so I believe it. And it's just the first one I picked to read. It's not like, I'm lying about this guy.
Wikipedia overall.
All right.
Okay, so it's Jerry Brudos, the shoe fetish slayer. You've seen, there's 1 million all true crime shows about him, and there's a Law and Order that's basically his story. So, Jerry Brudos is born January 31st, 1939
What's his name? I didn't hear that.
Jerry Brudos
okay.
Is born on January 31st, 1939 in Webster, South Dakota. And it turns out he was an accident, and his mother wanted a girl. They lived on a farm. When he was five, they moved to Portland, Oregon, and they basically move, it looks like every 2 to 5 years, his whole childhood and into his adult life, which sucks. And also it doesn't say this anywhere at all. That my theory is that his dad was an alcoholic or somebody in the family was an alcoholic where they had to just keep leaving town right. and starting over.
Right.
But also his dad starts out as a farmer, and it might just be that he's trying to basically be a migrant farmer and like go to the new place where he can make
follow
money.
Follow the money.
But every 2 years, it's just so disruptive
yeah.
and fucked up.
So sad.
So one day he's wandering around alone at the junkyard when he's 5 years old.
As you do.
And, he finds a pair of open-toed spike-heeled shoes. And he is obsessed.
No.
Immediately. Yes, this is his jam. He puts them on.
He probably never sees women wearing that kind of thing where he's from, maybe. Like, his mom probably doesn't wear shit like that.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But he goes crazy. He plays with them. He takes them home. His mom finds them and goes berserk on him and is like screaming, whatever, and like, never touch these again. You're not supposed to touch. You're not supposed to like this, whatever.
Which is a great way to get your kid to be really into something.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi, we know that.
So let's take a 5 year old
yeah.
and be like, this is forbidden.
Right.
And then this see what happens.
You don't understand why it's forbidden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eventually he kept finding them and like she would take them away from him. Finally, she burned them symbolically for him.
Perfect.
When he's six, they move to Riverton, California, and he's in the first grade. His teacher wore high heel shoes and kept another pair in the classroom. So he tried to steal them one day so he could take them home. But another kid in the class saw him and told on him. So from a first grade, this is like a very, very early age. He fails second grade. He is diagnosed with measles, sore throat, swollen glands, laryngitis. He has frequent headaches that actually leave him unable to see clearly.
Oh my God.
So he's got some stuff going on, but also all of those, illnesses that he has, it makes me go like, were you not taken care of very well?
Definitely.
You're not fed well.
Yeah.
Did you not sleep correct? You know, like why would you just be constantly sick?
Yeah.
So in 1947, when he's 8 years old, the family moves to Grants Pass, Oregon. And next door, there's a house that has, I think it's three teenage girls. Right. So they have a little brother, and Jerry starts sneaking into that house with the brother to steal these girls' underwear.
Oh, my God.
They play in the clothes, then he like discovers the underwear, and then so it goes from shoes to undergarments. Mm-hmm. A couple years later, the family moves again to Wallace Pond, because Jerry's father is getting back into farming. And when he's going through puberty, his mother is disgusted by anything sexual that Jerry does. You know, if he has a wet dream, she makes him wash his sheets by hand.
Oh my God.
There's a lot of shaming, a lot of like, sounds like verbal abuse.
How to create a serial killer.
Yeah. I mean, so he starts to fantasize that he wants to capture a girl and make her obey his commands beg for mercy. So when he's around 16, he steals an 18-year-old girl's underwear. Then he decides that he wants nude pictures of her. So he tells her that he has found out who stole her underwear and to meet him at his house. So the girl goes over to his house and she's attacked by a masked man, who forces her to take off her clothes and takes pictures of her. And then the man runs away. And Jesus. Then the girl gets dressed and she goes to leave and she runs into Jerry. And Jerry says, "I was locked in the barn this whole time. What happened? I just saw a guy running out of here in a mask." Mm. The girl runs away, reports the whole thing to police. Mm-hmm. So essentially he's trying to, and there was another story, but I could not find it anywhere, of him doing that and coming back in and saying that he was his own twin brother.
Oh my God.
And that really sorry. It was like one of the first times he did this. He's really sorry. He basically makes a young girl his age take off her clothes, takes pictures of her, leaves, changes his clothes, combs his hair differently, comes in and goes, "I'm sorry about my brother, Jerry. I'm his brother."
What a crazy, creepy, that like creeps me out.
It's so creepy. And of course, and I think that little girl from the story that I remember didn't report it to the police. It was just like this weird fucked up thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, I know it's also that kind of indicative of that, the sociopathic thing of I'm smarter than everybody. Mm-hmm. Like there's no way anyone's going to find out. Here's my great plan. Mm-hmm. I'm going to play my own identical twin.
Yeah.
Insane.
Yeah. This is not Full House.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay. So, when he's 17, he lures a girl into his car. He drives her to a deserted farmhouse, beats her up, and by some miracle, there's a couple that's like sightseeing out in the country and they stop at the same abandoned farmhouse.
What?
And they like walk in on what's happening and call the cops. So Jerry claims that he'd also stopped to help the girl because they find him and her and she's tied up. Mm-hmm. He says, "No, I found her that way. I was here to help her." Police don't believe it. And they talked to him long enough and he confesses. So he's arrested for assault and battery. And they find in his house and in his car, women's underwear, pictures and photo equipment. So soon after his arrest, they send him to Oregon State Hospital, the psychiatric ward, for 9 months.
How do you think that wasn't a fucking vacay, probably?
No.
A psychiatric hospital back then? What year is it?
It's 1969,
oh, no.
I believe.
Fuck
no, it. No, it's
fire hose.
Bad news.
Time.
He starts talking to the doctors there about his sexual fantasies, his hatred, and revenge, the revenge he wants to take against his mother and women in general. And he's diagnosed with schizophrenia, which was actually a common thing that would happen back then, that it wasn't actually an accurate diagnosis.
Like a blanket diagnosis.
Exactly. It was just kind of like you're what is that called? I want to say devious, but it's a, nothing?
I was going to say deviant. Devious.
Yeah, deviant. That's it.
Deviant. Okay. I was going to say that, but then you said devious. He's a deviant.
He's a deviant. That's what I was trying to say.
Got it.
Steven.
I love that you looked
you
at me like,
don't write that down. Can you help me? Will you try?
You said the only word I was thinking.
Okay. So, the things that he's telling them that he likes, they don't know how to classify that.
There's not a thing yet.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, whatever. There might have been, but they're basically like, slap schizophrenia on him and like...
Treat him for that, which is probably electric shock therapy.
He still graduates with this high school class in 1957.
Wow.
Oh, so this is the late 50s. It's not even the 60s.
Wow.
So then he joins the army in 1959. He tells the army psychiatrist about these same obsessions, and the psychiatrist has him discharged from the army. So he moves back in with his parents. Now they live in Corvallis, Oregon, and he has to live in their shed.
Oh,
they make him live out back in the shed.
I mean, he's an adult now. Can we please fucking treat him like a human
or get an apartment?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So, one night he's running an errand and, he sees a young girl walking by herself and he decides he's going to follow her. Mm-hmm. And he basically stalks her, follows her home, attacks her, strangles her until she's unconscious and then steals her shoes. And that night he slept with the shoes.
Oh my God. This is so creepy.
This is nothing.
Oh no.
Yeah. So he becomes an electronics technician in 1961. When he's 21, he gets a job at a radio station. And that's when he meets his future wife, 17-year-old Darcy Metzler. Yeah.
Oh, Darcy, run.
Darcy. Of course, Darcy's parents don't approve of the relationship because she's so young. And because of that, they're married within a few months of meeting each
other. That's how it's like, let's solve this by marrying them.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Well, it's like you want to get out of your parents' house anyway. Yeah. This guy comes along.
Yeah.
He loves underwear. You got to get him. So
tie that guy down.
Right.
Literally.
So they settle in Salem, Oregon. And Jerry's thing is he wants her to do all of her housework in the nude so he can take pictures of her while she's doing it.
Ugh, she's like, I'm sweating.
She's like, I'm Swiffering.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's so young that she's completely kind of under his control. Yeah,
she probably doesn't know what if this is normal or not.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is now married life.
Yeah.
She's, you know, like, I guess this is what you do as a wife.
Yeah.
And around the same time, he starts complaining that he's getting migraines so bad that he's blacking out. And that the only thing that helps alleviate those symptoms is going on night prowling raids to steal shoes and underwear from local women.
Everyone who's been taking Advil for your fucking migraines.
We've got a new solution.
Yeah.
It's a way creepier solution. So he would keep all of those trophies.
Trophies.
Shoes and underwear in a garage that he had built. It was like a sub-basement that his wife couldn't enter into until she announced her arrival on an intercom. He was locked down in this basement and she'd have to be like, honey, can I bring you some Ritz? Okay, so
let me put this away real quick.
Yeah, he has it set up where it's like, this is my man cave. You're not allowed down here. Mm-hmm. So in 1962, they have a daughter, but Jerry can't hold a steady job. They move all the time. They finally settle back in Portland. Jerry becomes an electrician. In 1967, they have a son, so two kids. But his wife won't let him in the delivery room when she's having her second baby. And he's so hurt by this, was what this article was saying. Or like, it affected him so much, that's when the raping and the killing starts.
Wait, isn't that normal for back then?
Yeah. I'm assuming this is his story of him being like, it pissed me off so much, you know, like that's the wife's fault.
I think that's so normal. I think even when in the 70s, when my brother was born, my dad wasn't allowed in there.
Right. Like, but this was the wife's decision. This is what they're saying.
Okay.
Yeah. So it makes it sound like he was allowed in for their first child and not this. Some weird thing had happened.
Yeah. That's why he.
That's what he says.
Yeah.
Of course, it's someone else's fault.
Right.
But also, I imagine they've now been married for 6 years or so. She's probably seen some weird shit and she's heard some weird shit. And there's a whole room she's locked out of all the time. So she's probably there's, you know, like, who knows what her state is.
She knows him well enough that he doesn't want to go in there for the miracle of his child being born. He wants to go in there for something fucking creepy.
She doesn't trust it.
Right.
How unnerving.
Oh my God. Like, if I see my husband's face when I'm giving birth, I'm gonna cry.
I will barf.
Barf and cry.
I'll barf, cry, and then shit on the table, which is what everyone does, apparently. That's, my friend Michelle Balloon does that.
No, I've heard that. It's terrifying. That's the most terrifying part.
Okay, so shortly after that, the childbirth, he claims that he stalked a woman in Portland, Oregon, followed her home, waited for her to fall asleep, broke into her house to steal her shoes. But then when she woke up mid-robbery and catches him, he chokes her until she passes out, rapes her, steals her shoes, and then leaves.
Oh my God.
So then in January of 1968, and this is the woman who Anne Brule's book starts with.
Oh, okay. I forgot about that part.
Yeah. So she starts with this, the first murder victim.
Okay.
And her name was, Linda Slauson. She was selling encyclopedias door to door in the rain in Portland.
Oh no.
And at night.
No. This sounds like a horror movie.
Completely. The way this is written, it's like she's trying to decide. She hasn't had any sales. No. She's just moved out on her own.
She's going to keep trying. Maybe the next one.
Yeah. She like needs the money. She has to eat. Like things are getting bad. And then there's like one last house that has a light on. And she's like, I just want to go home. I'll just try this one last house.
And back then they aren't as scared as we are today and weary.
No.
Wary of.
There were so many door-to-door salesmen and women back then.
Yeah. And you'd let them in your house and it was.
Yeah.
And 90% of the time, nothing happened.
That's right. Just a lot of vacuum sales.
Right.
Okay. So she goes up and she rings Jerry Brutus's doorbell. He is, you see a picture of him. He looks like a cartoon. He looks like the missing friend on King of the Hill. Like he's just, he looks like grown up Charlie Brown with army issue black glasses on.
Oh, grown up
just
Charlie Brown.
Just a big round head.
Like pasty.
No distinguishing features.
A little lumpy.
Yeah, kind of like almost like a bit of a snowman. Just round. Round.
I love the picture in my head. I never want to see what he actually looks like.
Just a vicious snowman.
Okay.
Okay. But when he answers the door, friendly, nice, low key, and I really wanted to get a set of those. Acts super interested. Then explains that his children were sleeping. I think that's what his excuse was. Can you come down into the basement? Yeah, so they could talk business down there. Well, she goes down, and he almost immediately hits her in the head with a 2x4, beats her, and then strangles her to death.
Oh my God.
And then.
Did he mean to that time, do you think?
Yes.
Okay.
That was the whole idea.
Because he was strangling till they passed out before that.
Right.
Okay.
But this girl comes to his door, and then he's like, the wife was out. And he knew he had time to do whatever he wanted. After she's dead and before he gets rid of the body, he takes off her clothes and dresses her up in the stolen underwear that he has in his collection.
Wow.
Then, this is bad, he cuts off her left foot and keeps it in the freezer in a high-heeled shoe. So it's like he has...
No, I'm just processing that. Holy shit! That is crazy.
Yeah. So then when he, and at some point there, his wife came home and he went back upstairs and like ate dinner with the family. I believe I read that in the Anne Rule book, but I'm almost positive that that's happening. He basically had family interactions like right after doing
this. Super normal. Well, probably as normal as he is.
Right. Yeah. He's probably always coming up from that sub basement a little bit sweaty.
Sure.
So later in that night, he rolls her in a rug, drives to a bridge, pulls out all the stuff to make it look like he got a flat tire almost like safety.
Okay.
And then dumps her body in the river. So then in July of 1968, so that was January. So 6 months later, Stephanie Vico is reported missing from Portland. And then in November the same year, Jan Susan Whitney is reported missing from Portland. Jan's 23-year-old college student at the University of Oregon. Then in March of 1969, so about 6 months later, a woman named Karen Sprinkler, who was a 19-year-old college student, goes missing.
Mm-hmm.
When the police take the eyewitness accounts of Karen going missing, two young girls tell the police they saw a large man dressed as a woman on the parking lot garage roof where Karen's abandoned car was found on that day.
Whoa.
If you see a picture of this guy and then you picture him lurking around like a parking structure dressed as a woman, it's very scary.
It sounds like Norman Bates.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. dressed like his mom kind of a thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Creepy.
Because probably from a distance, you're like, oh yeah, there's a woman up here on the same parking thing. You'd feel, I think that's part of what's so sinister to me. You're lured into safety of like, oh, that's a woman just like me. I'm fine.
I could see myself doing that.
Completely.
For sure.
Yeah. So a month later, a woman named Sharon Wood, is attacked in a parking garage at Portland State University. Mm-hmm. She fends off her attacker by biting his thumb until it bled. And it, of course, turns out to be Jerry. Once she does this, he beats her unconscious, but then a car comes. Mm-hmm. So he has to run. So, the police get the report of this, make no connection to the other parking garage attack. Mm-hmm. The next day after that attack, Jerry sees 14-year-old Leanne Brumley. He tries to abduct her. She fights him off and escapes.
Good for you.
Day after that, a woman named Linda Dawn Saley is reported missing. Her car's found abandoned in a parking garage. The police realize now that they're dealing with a serial killer. So the next month, which is May of 1969, a local fisherman discovers Linda Saley's body in the Long Tom River. It was weighed down by a car transmission. Mm. And then 2 days after that, Karen Sprinkler's body is found 50 feet away.
Oh my God.
So that's obviously his dumping ground.
Right.
Karen was also tied to an old engine, which is the reason it kept her submerged for a long time. And this is bad.
Okay.
He cut off her breasts to keep as souvenirs. He also placed a bra from his collection of undergarments over her mangled chest.
Oh my God.
Is the way they worded it. Yeah. So this guy is basically berserking. He's killing, he's trying to attack women almost daily.
Wow.
Killing people. And then these bodies are coming up of when he, like, it's just all going faster and faster.
Yeah, like he started and then was fucking on.
Yes. And then anytime he can't, you know, someone gets away, then he has to try it again the very next day.
Right.
So it's like,
wow.
So the same month, he starts calling dorm rooms at Oregon State University to try to arrange blind dates with the co-eds.
What the fuck?
And it works.
No.
Uh-huh.
What does he say?
Yeah, I don't know.
I want to know how he...
I would love to know. And I bet you it's in that book. I promise I'm going to finish reading this book.
I'm just wondering.
Everyone else should read it with me. But insane. The police now are onto the pattern. They're staking out places where young co-eds hang out, where they end up, like parking structure, stuff like that. A female student who claims to have gone on a blind date with this guy goes to police and gives his description. So now the police know what he looks like.
Wow.
And when he contacts her a second time for a follow-up date, she calls the police and tells them. So... the police show up at the meeting spot.
Fuck yeah.
They question Jerry, at the girls' residence hall.
So
fucking intense at Oregon State. But he's so cooperative and he gave his ID. Nothing came back. It all seemed legit. So he was not arrested. Because they had on him was you're just trying to make blind dates with people,
right,
which is not illegal.
Yeah.
But a bummer.
Yeah.
But then the police, after that interaction with him, go back and they look up his record. They look into him further.
Do you think that blind date went forward after that?
Yeah, yeah. She's like, once he got cleared by the cop, she's like, so do you like roller skating? So they look into his record. They decide to go to his house for some follow-up questions. And there they see several suspicious items in his garage, in his sub-basement thing. And they start building a case against him. Because they're like, the old classic line of cops, we like this guy. So eventually they have enough evidence to get an arrest warrant. He tries to run while the police are serving him with the arrest warrant.
Never do that. It's never going to work.
No. If the cops are there, you're done.
Yeah.
But the warrant was for the attempted abduction of Leanne Brumley from the month before.
Yeah.
And... So then they started, they get him in, take him downtown, whatever. They start interrogating him. And, he tries to call, he tries to call his wife and get her to burn stuff, clothing and like his underwear collection and all this other evidence.
He's like, now you can go into the sub basement.
Yeah, exactly right. Here's the basket.
Oh my God. Password.
But Darcy's like, go fuck yourself, mm-hmm. for real.
Darcy. So
Darcy's over it. She's had it. So the investigator's name was Jim Stovall, and he basically gets Jerry Brudos to confess to the murders, of the two recently discovered bodies, as well as the murder of Linda Slauson and Jan Whitney.
Wow.
Jerry Brudos is tested by several psychiatrists, and, he shows average IQ and cognition deemed not criminally insane, which I'm not, I don't understand.
Yeah, how can you be? Because how can you be a serial, like murder people and not be a little insane?
Yeah. But I'm not sure what criminally insane must have a very specific thing.
Hardcore. Yeah.
But he is diagnosed as an antisocial personality manifested by fetishism, transvesticism, exhibitionism, voyeurism, and sadism.
Isn't it funny that back then transvesticism is a crime?
Yes.
It's insane.
Yeah, and it wasn't that long ago. I mean, like, what is it? It's 1960...
something.
I lost my paper. We're in the late 60s, mm-hmm. 1969.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure someone's going to tell us when it went tell, and it's going to be recent.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they just fucking passed a thing. It's
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they collect all the evidence. He's eventually charged with three counts of first degree murder. Jan Whitney, Linda Saley, Karen Sprinkler. He, tries to, plead not guilty by reason of insanity. But eventually they just get him to plead guilty.
Uh-huh.
And so on the same day that he pleads guilty, he's sentenced to three consecutive life sentences because he confessed.
Right, right.
There's no death penalty in Oregon. So they just give him three consecutive life sentences. He's never charged with the murder of Linda Slauson because her body was never found.
Oh no.
Yeah.
That's so sad.
Now, around the time of all of these murders, 12 women went missing in that area, while he was free.
Oh my God.
So an investigation was ongoing to attempt to uncover the whereabouts of those other missing women. And at one point, a neighbor of the Brutuses implicated Darcy in the murders, claiming that she had helped Jerry carry a body from the garage. And she actually ended up going to trial for it and being acquitted.
Holy shit.
Yes.
Do you think she did? Because what a bummer to like have your husband turn out to be a serial killer and be you're implicated in it and have nothing to do with it.
I mean, that's what I would think. I don't know.
And
who knows?
Based on what she's already done, you would think that she would testify against him for immunity if she actually knew something.
Right. And if she didn't burn when he called and was like, get rid of the evidence, she's like, no way.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem like a person who's like in it for the long haul or like his accomplice.
Yeah.
For sure. And anyhow, he goes to jail. But he also had piles of women's shoe catalogs in his cell. He would write to the companies and ask for the catalogs. So he claimed that substituted for pornography for him.
Holy shit.
And he actually, it says he lodged countless appeals, including one in which he lodged countless appeals, including one in which he alleged that a photograph taken of him with one of the corpses could not prove his guilt because it was not the body of the person he was convicted of killing. So they found a picture of him posing with a dead body.
But who took it?
Well, probably him, I would imagine.
Right, on a timer, maybe.
Yeah, kitchen timer.
Yeah.
But so it's like that kind of thing where he's arguing like, look, that's not the dead body. Then, hey, you can't
someone
like,
else.
It's so insane. It's a picture of you posing with a dead body.
Yeah.
Anyway, he died in prison on March 28, 2006 from liver cancer.
He lived for a long fucking time.
In fact, at the time of his death, he was the longest incarcerated inmate in the Oregon Department of Corrections, a total of 37 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
My age. Yeah. How my entire life is how long he was in prison.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
So if you want to read Lust Killer, I'm going to finish it and then we'll know all those details. Cause wow. I really do want to know like all that stuff at the end. Yeah. And I bet you it'll talk more about Darcy too. Cause I'm sure she talked to Anne Roll. I bet you she talked
you
to Anne
Roll. You think so?
I bet she did.
I'd love to hear more from Darcy.
I'll try to finish that up pretty soon. But also thanks to those people from Radford University. Your research helped me do my thing.
Thanks, guys. Shout outs to fucking helpers this episode. Wired magazine, all this. Wow. What a creep. I had never heard that one.
It's bad.
Yeah.
It's one of those ones I've been working on, but every time I go to do it, I'm like, it's just there's no, but the only thing it was the 2 points, I always look for those cinematic moments. One cinematic moment is a person dressed up like a woman hiding in a parking garage.
Yes.
Which is the scariest, like beyond.
Yeah.
And then the other one, is that as a child attacking that little girl and then being like, I'm my twin brother.
Oh my
where it's like,
God.
How fucking crazy are you?
That's like psycho level.
Yeah. Do you have a good thing for this week?
I have a good thing this week. Obviously, it's Elvis getting better and Mimi getting better. But now that they are better, I can say what it was going to be last week before this happened, which is a kitten, man, a new kitten. Like nothing will make it more exciting in your house. Like just watching her playing with a little toy by herself is like joyous.
Yes.
And then at night, oh my God, at night, she tries to nurse Vince's head and it drives him crazy. But it's like I pull her away, but not before I look at it for a minute. It's just so cute. And she like nuzzles and she's a real character. And I like having her around.
She's super cute.
Yeah.
And it's funny because she matches Mimi. It's like they have the same jacket on, but Mimi's like, I fucking hate you.
Mimi's jacket's like obviously a little more worn in. It's because it's a little lighter in color. Yep. She's washed it more and she fucking hates the kitten.
Yeah.
Her kitten's name is Dottie. She's a real doll. So what's yours?
Mine is, I did a show last night at Largo. It was a comedy show for Brian Posehn, who's been doing comedy for 30 years. So it was his 30 year anniversary in comedy. So he asked a bunch of us to do the show with him he's been doing it with that long. And so it was me, Blanka Patch, Derek Sheen, Dana Gould, Greg Proops, and Guy O'Belam. And it was such a good show.
Idea for a show.
It was so fun. And then, so everyone was like obviously doing their act, but then also telling these stories and doing jokes from their act from back then.
Wow.
It was so fun. And everyone was so insanely solid. But then it also was like, at a couple moments, it was very touching because I was like, I said something about how lucky I felt to have kind of happened into this tribe that I found where it's like, you know, when those people in San Francisco, those comics that I met and got to be friends with we all just moved en masse to LA together.
Yeah.
And it was just such an amazing group of talented people who are geniuses and so fun. And like telling stories where we're like, I had a recovered memory on stage where I was like, Brian, remember when OJ ran and we were in Golden Apple Comics? And like, it was just like a whole thing like that.
Yeah.
Where it was really, really fun.
That's such a nice thing to like, you know, you're going through this and you've been in comedy this long and you're doing it. But then to like stop and take stock of it.
Yeah.
It's such a cool thing. And I like that you guys did that.
I did too. And it takes stock in this kind of like, it was almost like a high school. It had a high school feeling in the like meaning and the,
you're part of this big force and you're part of it. You belong in it.
And I think like when you're in that, you of course don't appreciate it because you're young and an asshole and drunk all the time and kind of on pills. But when you later on, when you get older, you know, just know that like if when you have your like posse of friends, it doesn't last because everyone gets married or, you know, maybe moves away or whatever.
Or quits comedy for whatever reason.
Exactly.
Like
it's just kind of people move away from each other and in ways that you kind of don't expect. And then, so I think there was a nice kind of like, reunion feel to it that I really
That's
liked.
So awesome.
Yeah. It's those good feelings.
Yay.
And I hate doing stand-up comedy so much, and I very often cancel my sets because I'm like, there's no point. And I knew I couldn't do it because I wouldn't do that to Brian.
That's a special one.
So then when I was actually doing it, I was like, oh, I do like it. That's right. I do like comedy.
Yeah. It's just, you got to pick the ones that mean something to you, I guess.
Yeah, and just like acknowledge when I'm busy.
Right.
And tie.
Tired and busy.
I get so tie.
So tired. Well, should I see if anyone is going to talk? Elvis isn't. Mimi?
Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you guys for listening.
Go on to the website if you want to get those pre-sale tickets for the upcoming tour. Australia, heads up. Australia, get ready.
Get in there.
Australia, be our friend.
Yeah.
And that's it. Stay sexy.
Don't get murdered. Bye.
Bye.
Mimi, want a cookie?
No.
Mimi.
No.
Not this week.
Mimi's like leaning away from the microphone.